in the epilogue, George.
The UFO Synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is David Hatcher Childress. David Hatcher Childress is known as the real-life Indiana Jones to the many fans of his books. He is a captive individual. He has traveled the world several times over, seeking adventure and the answers to the mysteries of mankind's past. David has a wide scope of interest and is a recognized expert not only on ancient civilizations and technologies, but also on free energy, anti-gravity, and UFOs. The number of his books he has written on these and other topics is astounding. His latest book is Mystery of the Olmec. David, how are you this evening?
Hey, great. Good to be on your show.
Pardon?
I said it's good to be on your show.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here with us tonight. You have so many different subjects that you cover, and I, like everyone knows with this program, I try to deal mainly with the UFO topic. And I understand you've done quite a bit of research in the Vimanas from the Vedic texts, and ancient civilizations that may have had advanced technologies that aren't recognized by modern archaeology?
Yeah, that's right. One of my most popular books actually is a book called Technology of the Gods, and that has a chapter on Vimanas in it. Years before, I did an entire book about Vimanas, Vimana aircraft of ancient India and Atlantis. We reprinted some of the ancient Indian texts about Vimanas, including the Vimanika Shastra.
Okay. Could you explain a little more to people who aren't familiar with the Vimanas on what they are?
Yeah. You know, when you read particularly the ancient texts in India, the Ramayana, which is actually part of the Mahabharata, the Dronaparva, and things like that. I mean, they read like the wildest science fiction. You've got people flying through the air, blasting each other. There's horrific wars, literally like atomic warfare and stuff like that is described in the Mahabharata and Dronaparva and stuff like that. The story of Ram, which is the famous Ramayana, and a lot of that is covered in my book on the Vimana aircraft of ancient Indian Atlantis, where you have essentially kind of a story of a wayward princess. Her name is Sita, and she's married to this prince. His name is Rama. But she runs off with this other guy and goes to Sri Lanka. Rama gets bummed out. He goes and meditates for a while. This is all like 10,000 years ago or something. And finally, he decides, hey, I'm going to go get my wife back. And he gets in his Vimana. And the ancient texts are very clear about this, kind of like Noah's Ark or something, being a boat. Vimanas are aircraft. They fly through the air. Every Hindu, Buddhist knows what a Vimana is. They all know these stories. And Vimanas are mentioned in many other stories, too. There's different types of Vimanas, in fact. But, you know, a lot like when you read some modern novel or something like the hero suddenly flies to London or something like that, and a novelist doesn't suddenly stop and tell you what an airplane is, what airports are. He knows that you know all that stuff. And that's how the ancient Hindu epics were, too. they were written to people, translated over and over again for thousands of years. We know these epics are thousands of years old, and they know that you know what a Vimana is. So they talk about Vimanas, but they don't go into great detail about them, you know, exactly what they look like, the propulsion systems, things like that. But what happened in 1908, this ancient book was discovered in the Royal Baroda Library. And that book was all about Vimanas. I mean, it was entire text about Vimanas. And it was called the Vamanika Shastra, Vamanika being another Sanskrit word for Vimanas. And it was written by this guy in the 4th century B.C., Bharadwaji the Wise. And he says it's translated from other older books and stuff like that. And really unusual book, because it is a book that is just about these aircraft. And he talks about there being four or five different kinds of Vimanas. Some Vimanas are apparently fixed-wing type aircraft. One type of Vimana seemed like a helicopter, actually. Another type of Vimana was some kind of tubular airship or Zeppelin or cigar-shaped kind of craft. And then there was also a discoid flying saucer type craft, too. And the Vimanika Shastra gets very specific. It talks about Mercury being part of the propulsion system. Does talk in about some kind of electricity or something. These things fly through the air. They talk about the pilots, even kind of aerial maneuvers and things like that. They were clearly used for warfare, just like machines and stuff are today. So, I mean, in some ways, this is kind of like your Eric von Däniken's, you know, original Chariots of the Gods kind of thing with these craft. But they're, you know, when you read the ancient Indian epics, these people, well, they're gods, but they're you know, humans too. And in fact, they have jealousy. They live in the forest. They go to parties and stuff like that. They go to big feasts. Their wives run away from them and run off with other men, stuff like that. But when the time comes, they get pissed. This is like the Ramayana story. And they get in their airship, they go flying to this other guy, they get their wife back, you know, they kick some butt. And that is basically the story of the Ramayana.
Well, you know, it sounds to me like the description of the Vimanas fits a lot alongside those little golden, what look like delta wing aircraft found in South America.
Yeah, that's right. Those are found in Colombia. Today those are in the museum in Colombia, and they look like delta winged airplanes and things like that. So when you have that kind of depiction, and in fact, like when you're in India, what they're really talking about in India when you're there is kind of, and they often depict Vimanas, but typically it is kind of a chariot, it's flying through the sky, often giant swans or something like that.
I've also seen paintings that describe them as almost a floating city.
Yeah, and some of them really apparently were like really huge. And then you have your whole kind of mothership thing. You get ideas. Too, of these guys going to the moon and other planets. These things are like electric, although some of them were apparently similar to, you know, the fixed-wing planes or helicopters. Others were some kind of anti-gravity plasma kind of thing. In the, you know, the book on Vimanas, we talk about there being some kind of mercury vortex. Mercury is interesting too. It's a liquid, it's a metal, it's a conductor. You can use mercury in a, like a gyroscope, and then you can electrify it and have these electrified gases that are moving in a vortex, gyroscopic manner or something. And, you know, physicists have shown that, that this has some kind of a lift. And in fact, when you get into UFO stuff, you wonder whether some of, say, the Area 51 type experiments and even things going back to World War II and Tesla and things like that, if they were not also, you would think they would be experimenting with these, with mercury, with plasma vortexes, these electrified gases in some kind of a swirling. And in fact, it's kind of curious because the main town, if you will, at Area 51, where Bob Lazar and these workers and stuff would go, is in fact called Mercury. How about that?
Well, I thought for a long time they were going to, like, Rachel.
Well, you know, that's not where... Rachel is not where people who work at Area 51 go. You know, Rachel is on the north side of Area 51. If you work in Area 51, I mean, you either... You don't live in Rachel. You either live... Many workers at Area 51 live in Las Vegas. And every night they go out gambling and go to strip shows or something like that. Astronauts, too. And have, you know, since the 50s. But if you work at Area 51, including Bob Lazar, you would drive, it's about a 45-minute drive west out of Las Vegas, and then you pull off the highway, there's a sign on the interstate and everything, and it says Mercury, Mercury, Nevada. You can't go there unless you have a special pass, but you can actually see a town north of the interstate. And it's a totally, it's a secret city in a sense. You can see it. You can't go there. And the name of it is Mercury. And you kind of wonder if, you know, they're doing special anti-gravity experiments and other craft here, why they would even give it that name. Because in many ways, that has to do with, apparently, Vimana.
Oh, that's cool. Now, when they're telling the stories of the Vimanas in, and I know I'm going to mangle the pronunciation of this, the Mahasarada, is that close enough? Was describing battles between the quote-unquote gods and some of the weaponry they used and the destructive force that these weapons used. Are you of the school thinking that these weapons were of an atomic or nuclear nature?
Well, I think of some of them, and yeah, I mean, there's is some evidence that certain cities and areas were somehow like nuked in the past. One of my most popular books, actually, is Technology of the Gods book, and that has been translated into a number of foreign languages, French and Korean and German and Russian. And I have an entire chapter in that book about ancient atomic warfare, these vitrified cities, these areas of the desert there in Iraq and also in parts of the Egyptian and Libyan desert, where they're just areas of the desert have been turned into sheets of glass. And that's real similar to what happens with atomic testing and things like that, where, like White Sands, New Mexico or something, in the desert is turned to sand.
Like the geologist who had discovered a vast area of the huge green glass in Africa, later, 50 years later, was taken to the Trinity site and was shown, you know, the same type of green glass from the test of the bomb. And he realized at the time that, hey, this looks just like what I saw in Africa.
Yeah, there's a special name for that glass, too. It's and there's an old rock shop out there in New Mexico, out in the desert, near Roswell and all that. And that rock shop, it's real old desert rock town, rock shop, and I always stop there when I'm heading into Roswell or something, and he sells. That glass, and I've bought some. It's, you buy it by the gram or something, but it is this special glass. It's radioactive too, still a little bit, and
I don't doubt.
Yeah, so you have that. I mean, it seems amazing to people, that what life was like. And I mean, that's a lot of what my book on Technology of the Gods and the Vimana books and all my books, like on Lost Cities and even in a way, my book, Extraterrestrial Archaeology and stuff, is that, yeah, I mean, the ancient past, the ancient world was different than we think. I mean, and the idea that people were just cavemen 10,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, and then we suddenly stepped out of our caves and started building some pyramids and things like that. And it's like this straight line graph from ancient, caveman up to modern man, and here we are. And it's just not like that. That graph would look like a roller coaster of ups and downs. There would be times
kind of following the contours of the ground.
Yeah, and the idea that there have been golden ages and ages of science and science and technology, and people are curious, and that's what all the legends say. So you have, and that's part of the whole story of Atlantis, really. I mean, Atlantis is essentially civilization that's over 10,000 years ago, before the floods, shall we say. And these people built giant cities. They built out of huge 100-ton blocks of stone. They built giant obelisks and things like that, and we don't even know why or how they could do some of this stuff. But, they took, like, a lot of the stuff you see in South America in these giant cities, huge walls and things like that. When you go to Machu Picchu, around Cusco, I mean, they say, mainstream archaeology is saying that the Incas just built these huge walls just a few hundred years before the Spanish got there. I mean, these walls aren't even thousands of years old. When you look at them, huge blocks of stone, they're like, the size of a railway car in some cases. Just stacked up and in many cases perfectly cut and fitted together. And you wonder how they could possibly have done that, when in fact, a modern Peruvian, even American construction crew couldn't even really do that. And if they did, I mean, it would be this giant, construction project. But these people supposedly didn't know the wheel, they didn't have writing, of course, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have machines and things like that. They wouldn't even have things like the Romans had, block and tackle and pulleys and levers and stuff like that, because they supposedly didn't know the wheel. It's bizarre. So what I do in all my books,
Stone Age people, the pre-Columbian Indians were all considered Stone Age people.
Well, yeah, know that in South America and certain areas of like Mexico and stuff, that they had iron, that there were metal tools and things like that. But yeah, I mean, this is part of the enigma too of the conquest of the United States and the Great Plains, is that Indians within the United States totally lived in the Stone Age. And they did not have metals. They had no draft animals, although in South America they did. And they had mines. They had found copper clamps and things like that at Tiwanaku. A tremendous amount of gold too, which is such a soft metal that it's not really very useful in say, tools and implements and things like that. You need something harder. They would mix gold with silver too and make electrum and things like that. Even they found platinum down there. And this gets into the whole thing of the mystery of metals, ancient mines. Mining too creates these underground things. And you have also legends of all these tunnels and things like that. In my books, on Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries of South America, and Lost Cities in North and Central America, in fact, all my books like that, I talk about these weird tunnel systems, even, too, associated with Vimanas and things. You have stories of these ancient tunneling machines. Here you go, and this starts to spin over into your Hollow Earth type theories, where you have, a whole underground world. Going underground makes sense. And the idea that if you think, and you know, and what I'm arguing in my books on technology of the gods and Lamont aircraft and things like that, is that, the ancient world was very different. And it wasn't consumer society so much like we have today, where with all these advertising and different things to buy, different brands and things like that. But still, they had, they had airships, they had electricity, they had machines, they had power tools, they had special, mining, melting kind of things. They had the ability, I believe, to not only cut and melt rock, they could lift giant blocks with some kind of levitation device. They had different understandings too of kind of physics and more of a unified field, magnetism, gravity, and with all that, it has to do with harmonics, vibration, reality itself, and physical reality. But once you understand all that, you can levitate things, you can manipulate craft, where you would have anti-gravity type craft. You have with these guys building these giant antennas around the world. And that gets into obelisks. You have these giant standing stones, and part of that subject is ley lines and the whole idea of the grid, this PowerPoint vortex area grid. You have these magnetic earth lines that are running through and around the earth, and then they intersect, they create these vortex areas. And it's interesting too, I mean, I'm just doing a show with a History Channel about this, which has to do with UFOs and the world grid, these power spots, vortex areas where weird things and stuff like that happens. And even the idea of Coral Castle would be like that. You've maybe talked about that on your show before.
Well, and then there's a conjunction, I guess you could call it, of 12 major ley lines or grid lines or whatever you want to refer to them as, near the Arizona-Mexico border. Do you think that this could be part of the reason why there's so many UFO-related reports?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I'm not that familiar with all that, although, I can kind of see that something like that would maybe be the case. The whole Four Corners area is quite an unusual area, and you have Shiprock there in very northwest corner of New Mexico. And with the Navajos, who live all around there, and that's part of the Navajo Reservation, have this whole legend, too, that this ship flew. I mean, it's a giant rock out in the desert. But they have this legend that, flew through the air, and that they came from the north, also like flying, and that somehow, this weird rock out in the desert, which they call Shiprock, an airship turned to stone or something like that. So I seems like just a weird stone formation in a way, yet there's probably, I believe, something to these legends of them flying through the air and coming from somewhere else.
Oh, well, now you've got me wanting to go up that direction and check it out. I've driven through that area once, but it was very, very late at night, and all I could think about was getting home. Well, on that note, we need to go to a break, and we'll be back in just a little while with our guest tonight, David Hatcher Children, Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Radio Network.
Sheridan for UFO Global Focus. Starting Sunday, November 18th, the UFO Paranormal Radio Network will be broadcasting our new program. Each UFO Global Focus show, airing Sundays 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, will center on a particular international and study aspect of ufology. We hope you'll listen and join the discussion.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Eye of the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is David Hatcher Childress. David, just before we went to the break, I was noticing a question in our virtual auditorium here in Powell Talk, and it was concerning the green glass. And Linda Keeper was asking, where are these areas where this green glass was found, and is there any other way this glass could happen, or any natural way?
Well, there is maybe, the way they say these glassy areas occur is through some kind of meteorite, comet, impact, something that's but kind of striking the Earth at a kind of a, and not creating a big crater, and that's one of the mysteries of these glassy areas. These glassy areas are found all over the world. The main ones that are the most famous are in southwestern Egypt. If you look on a map, and I've got maps of all this stuff in the book, Technology of the Gods. But if you look at a map of Egypt and Libya, North Africa, and you see where kind of down in the middle of Sahara, and I've been in all this area, and I used to live in Sudan and Egypt, so but that right where Egypt and Sudan and Libya all come together. And that is just a like kind of vast, empty sand desert right there. But right in that area is this famous area of all this this glass. And it's in fact, it was in the 30s when a British geologist was going out of that area in a four-wheel drive Jeep thing, Land Rover. And he drove out into that area, and you're just driving through the desert. And it's flat. There are sand dunes and stuff in some of those areas. Otherwise, it's kind of a rocky, flat desert, sandy too. And suddenly, his tires of his Jeep just were crunching through all of this glass. And he got out and was walking around in it. And there's photographs and stuff of it. Some of this glass, in fact, strangely, ended up in Tutankhamun's tomb, and Tutankhamun with all his famous different masks and golden caskets and the tremendous jewelry and stuff that they did. And I mean, that too, right there, shows you a very high level of technology and tremendous skill in working with metals and jewelry, precious stones and things like that. But yeah, some of this glass, incredibly, has actually ended up in Tutankhamun's jewelry and stuff like that. Other areas where there's glass, there's other areas, the Sahara, as is. One of the earliest reports of this glass was in Iraq, actually, digging up one of the cities of Ur. Some of these ancient Sumerian cities were vitrified, and that's a similar mystery that's also associated with this theory of ancient atomic warfare and stuff, is that you've got vitrified areas. These Hittite cities in the middle of Turkey also are vitrified. You have certain parts of Scotland and forts, and here you have, with vitrification, actual cities, and they're melted. And what's happened here is bricks and stone walls and things like that are subjected to tremendous heat, and they melt, and they fuse together. And this happened. This can happen to. It's just how ceramics are made today. But the big thing about that, and even Arthur C. Clarke in his TV show *Mysterious World*, and then the books too that went along with that. That's one of the chapters where they go to one of these vitrified forts in Scotland, trying to figure out how all these walls were melted, and stones and things like that. And the way they figured it must have happened, because it couldn't be some, super weapon or some atomic weapon or other, kind of beam weapon that was going to melt the stone or something. I mean, that's just not part of their theory. It had to be something more simple. So, I mean, their thing was to try in the TV show where they pushed all this brush and logs and things against these walls. And then they kind of assumed that there was also maybe wooden structures somehow associated with these walls that were defensive that they were trying to destroy. But, I mean, essentially, the whole idea was to, just have a big fire around some ancient fort and see if it would melt the stone like these stones are. I mean, where they're vitrified. Melted and then reformed. I mean, rocks just melted and then fused together. They couldn't really do it, and so the idea that some simple fire or, but it is possible. But this is what you're looking at. I mean, and again, this goes back to the Ramayana, what we were talking about before, these horrific wars with the in ancient India and stuff like that. I mean, they're talking about just wiping out entire cities. Everyone's killed. The cities, in some ways, melted and stuff like that. When the first archaeologists began excavating in what is today Pakistan and also along in India as well, and in fact, this area where all these ancient cities are found, like this, largely is this the Thar Desert area, which is basically the border between India and Pakistan today. And they came to cities like Mohenjo-Daro and Kote Digi and Harappa, and I write about these places too in my book on Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India, where archaeologists, and this was in the late 40s, right after World War II, what they found was people were literally dying dead in the streets. I mean, they were just like some doom had come over these cities. And thousands of years ago, they date these cities right now as being like 1000 BC or 2000 BC, something like that. I think they may be older than that. But people were just lying dead in the streets. And they found also these melted lumps of black glass. And later when they study these melted lumps, what they found they were pottery. they were vessels and things like that, and that they had been subjected to some really intense heat and melted. So here you again have, you know, what seems to be some kind of validation of the ancient Indian epics that are talking about Vimanas and these flying machines, horrific wars that are devastating entire cities. And in fact, I mean, this is, there's photos of it too. If you go to the museums there, and they're in my book too, on Vimanas and my book on Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India, where, yeah, I mean, people are just lying dead in the streets. And no one was left alive to bury the dead. And in fact, I mean, this doom came over these cities, vitrified parts of it. People were lying just in the streets, holding hands, dead. And then the desert just came in and just covered these cities with dust and sand. And then 50 years ago, archaeologists began digging them up. But it was just so incredible. I mean, and this is one of the problems with archaeologists today. They have, you know, a foundation that they base everything on, and that is that ancient people were primitive. I mean, and if ancient people were primitive and they were cavemen, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have things like then. I mean, they couldn't. I mean, if you don't have these, you know, all this technology, then I mean, these, you just assume these things can't happen. Now you get the flip side of all that, which would be your chariots of the gods kind of thing, where, okay, we have proof of wars, we have proof of aircraft, we have proof of high technology, but since people were cavemen, you know, and didn't have technology, well, then how can there be high technology? Well, one answer for that is, well, spacemen from outer space came. It's their technology. They brought it. They built those walls. That was their Vimanas that were being flying around in. It was their weapons that vitrified these walls and things like that. And in fact,
one quick question from again from our virtual auditorium, and I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this name correctly. I think it's Lyandon. Wants to know, what about radiation levels in those places where the glass is found?
Yeah, right. Supposedly, yeah, that skeletons out of these places did, some of them did test for high radioactivity. And it was a Russian book that came out in the 60s that these skeletons were highly radioactive. So, and you would think that they would be. Even, I mean, it's kind of interesting, too, that with the atomic bomb tests in the 50s, Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the hydrogen bomb, was widely quoted in after the test as quoting from the Mahabharata and saying that, quoting of one of these destructive weapons of, you know, now I am Shiva, you know, the destroyer of worlds and stuff like that. So Oppenheimer was totally familiar with these ancient Indian epics, the horrific wars that they talked about, talking about these amazing technology that, I mean, it's, you know, out of an epic poem, basically. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I believe that within sort of the secret government and the military and stuff, they, many of the scientists, I mean, Einstein was like this, Tesla, Oppenheimer, von Braun and stuff, that they're heavily immersed into weird legends, occult stuff. JPL was like that, and Jack Parsons and stuff like that, who founded JPL. These guys are, and kind of the way we associate the Nazis with Indiana Jones movies and things like that, as being totally obsessed with weird occult things and Norse legends, and also with the ancient India and these Vimanas and stuff.
Getting in with the ancient technology and UFOs, your book, the Extraterrestrial Archaeology, what's some of the things that your book, that book in particular covers?
Well, and, you know, in that book, and that's gone through a couple of different editions now, and there are some foreign language versions of it too. You know, I was fascinated, of course, with, you know, the face on Mars and stuff like that, but back in the 70s, right, when America was had gone to the moon and all that, and all that, those sort of things were kind of fresh on everyone's mind, the number of curious books came out. One was called Our Mysterious Spaceship Moon. Another was called Somebody Else is on the Moon. And those books were all about how the moon was occupied. There were rovers running around on the moon, mining it. UFOs, of course. Structures on the moon, pyramids, domed cities, even, you know, ancient, like Vimanas, you know, crashed on the moon. Very kind of sci-fi type stuff. And, you know, I mean, it was fascinating stuff. And so I wanted to look into that. I began poring over NASA photos. I started getting all the books I could of moon photos. Some of them were for Britain and stuff like that, too. There were a lot of photos, too, from the Soviet space program. And began assembling these and looking into it. And throughout the book, I mean, there's quite a few chapters about the moon, and the book's heavily illustrated, you can imagine. With drawings, discussing all these things. So these, supposedly, there are these robot rovers that move on around the moon, scooping up the moon and mining it. Real similar, actually, to, like, Star Wars and stuff. And where they're on that desert planet of Tatooine, and these kind of, you know, robotic-type giant machines kind of lumber through. And the idea is on the moon. And the moon, by the way, is tremendously rich in special metals and things like that. If you're mining the moon, you've got a great mining concession. The moon is totally jam-packed with chromium, titanium, special metallic alloys and things like that, and elements, rare metals and things.
Recently, there's been a lot of talk about HE3, which is a form of helium that is very rare here on Earth, but is in abundance on the moon.
On the moon, yeah, okay, right.
It's a potential energy source.
Well, right, and I mean, the idea that you would set up bases on the moon and start making, yeah, this special helium isotopes. You in space, you can do certain things like grow special crystals and things. Is one of the things they do, space station and whatnot. Just literally scooping up the crust of the moon. You know, you would start processing it. You would probably go underground on the moon to get away from all the solar rays and things like that. Even some craters on the moon may not be impact craters, but and this is what, you know, some of these authors in the 70s thought, was that some of these craters were literally open pit mines. Certain craters on the moon too. I mean, people have been watching the moon now for a couple hundred years with pretty good telescopes and things, and you know, it's only been a recent, very recent thing that you know, good photographs of the moon have started to come out, and certain photographs too. I mean, even into the 50s and stuff were taken through telescopes of the moon. But people would notice that certain craters kind of changed and changed shape and stuff like that, which would be consistent with them being basically mined. The whole thing of the moon itself as a kind of giant spaceship, and there's a lot of oddball things about the moon. The moon itself is at a certain orbit on the Earth that's pretty unusual. And I talk about this right at the very beginning of the book, where, you know, we're all so familiar with how the moon, you know, kind of strangely actually, manages to rotate and revolve around the Earth. In doing so, it always keeps only the one face to the Earth, and the dark side of the moon is literally always kept from being viewed. And it wasn't until we were able to send space probes and stuff like that out to the moon in the early 60s that we were able to get like photographs and stuff of what was going on the backside of the moon. And certainly from the point of view that the moon's inhabited and there's activity on the moon, bases on the moon, mining on the moon, yeah, then perhaps they were going to see all that on the backside of the moon, and some, according to some stories, that they did. But the other strange thing about the moon, aside from keeping the dark side always away from us, is that the orbit that the moon is in around our planet is very special, it seems, because the size of the moon is of a certain size, and it, when there is an eclipse on the surface of the Earth, and you know, you have to be at certain places on the Earth at a certain time to see a solar eclipse, but should you see one, and they do occur all the time, what happens during an eclipse is, and I'm talking about total eclipse here, the disk of the moon transits across the disk of the sun. And if you're standing at the right place on our planet at the time and you see this, it's a curious phenomenon because during the total eclipse, and the disk of the moon, it will cover then the disk of the sun. And it not more and not less covers the disk of the sun. And so, and you know, I mean, we've all seen photos. It's dangerous to actually watch an eclipse, you know, without special glasses and stuff. But you know, what happens is, I mean, it's a fantastic event, and scientists study it today every time it happens. And you see then the disk of the moon utterly perfectly covering the disk of the sun. Not more, not less. And you see then the corona of the sun going out of this dark disk. But the idea that our moon is in some arbitrary captured orbit, as you know, astrophysicists would maintain, I mean, it's a zillion to one that our moon would be in that position. Because if the moon was just a little bit closer to the Earth, it would more than cover the disk of the sun. If the moon a little bit farther from the Earth, it would less than cover the sun. But our moon is in such a position that it, not more, not less, perfectly covers the sun. That it would be in that position arbitrarily is astronomical odds. It's as if our moon is placed in a special orbit. I mean, and that its orbit around our planet is not in any way arbitrary. It's like a spaceship. I mean, if you look at the moon on any other planet, look at the moons on Mars, for example. They're much, much smaller than our moon. And if you were, you know, happen to be watching a Martian eclipse, where, you know, I mean, they would just be tiny rocks moving across the face of the sun. So this kind of thing, and in fact, this was the title of one of the books in the 70s called Our Mysterious Spaceship Moon by Don Wilson. And, I mean, if you, you know, scour used paperback bookstores and stuff, you could probably find a copy of this book. It has photos in it, so it's you know, not a good one to be looking for pyramids on the moon and stuff, but that was a lot of his contention in his book, was that the moon, and NASA later proved all this too, in a sense, that the NASA, because it was assumed for many years that our moon was a sister, you know, satellite to the Earth, and had somehow been formed when our Earth was formed, and even the early theory in the 50s was that the moon came out of the Pacific Ocean and was spewed out, and that Zachariah Sitchin in his book still talks about this, although apparently it's been proven wrong. But yeah, that the Pacific Ocean is this giant, you know, kind of hole in the Earth, and that the moon came from it. And, you know, in that case, the moon and the Earth would be the same age. Their makeup of the rocks on the moon would be like, similar to rocks on the Earth, you know, that kind of thing. But according to NASA, when they made the moon landings and stuff, and they analyzed moon rocks and whatnot, what they claimed is that, yeah, moon rocks aren't like the Earth. And in fact, the moon is not from the Earth. And then they then claimed that the moon, they claimed, was millions of years older than the Earth and had to come from some other solar system. Now, how about that? So here you have a scenario, literally straight from NASA, although they won't say it, where they're saying, yeah, the moon's from some other solar system. It was brought here, put into orbit around our planet. How about that?
I have to, unfortunately, break in because it's time for us to go to our top of the hour break. And we'll come back to this cool topic here in just a few minutes here on Eyes of the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Online shopping this holiday season has just gotten a whole lot easier. FlowerGirlPrincess.com is ready for all your special occasion needs. We carry Flower Girl, Pageant, Bridesmaid, Prom, and Sweet 16 gowns, as well as a collection of designer holiday dresses for girls. Ordering from us is easy, secure, and fast. Remember, FlowerGirlPrincess.com will turn your little flower girl into a princess for her special day. Visit us online today and enter to win a free dress of your choice. FlowerGirlPrincess.com.
Hi. I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests and we talk about all sorts of things. Some are authors, some are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.giascott.com.
Are you ready to know
that angels, ETs, and light beings walk beside you?
Are you ready to know
that not only are you their creation, you may be them as well?
Are you ready
to know that you have been trapped in your own beliefs, in your own mind, and never knowing who and what you truly are?
Let's explore these concepts and theories, and we'll hear what they have to say. Join us Sunday nights, 8 Pacific Eastern. I'm Joshua James, your host of Cinema Lights on Paranormal Radio Network. See you Sunday.
Good evening, good afternoon, or good morning, wherever you may be. I am Sean Lonker, your host on the Midnight Highway Radio on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join me on Saturday night, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And together we can take a ride down the Midnight Highway. My topics include UFOs, ghosts, near death, and many other various subjects regarding the paranormal. My goal is to seek the truth, find the answers that we all so deeply crave. So when the witch sings on Saturday nights, guys and girls, be sure to check me out. You can also visit me at www.midnighthighwayradio.com. Don't forget, Saturday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Take care, guys.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evening on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, this is Trish Sheridan for UFO Global Focus. Starting Sunday, November 18th, the UFO Paranormal Radio Network will be broadcasting our new program. Each UFO Global Focus show, airing Sundays 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, will center on a particular international and study aspect of ufology. We hope you'll listen and join the discussion.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
listening to You Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we're talking with David Hassler Childress. David, I got another quick question here for you from the audience that was sent to me in a private message, and wanted to know if you know about the original meaning of the swastika symbol referring to the hyperdimensional torsion field energy.
Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, stuff like that has been certainly suggested, even in, like, the George Adamski books and stuff like that. They talked about the swastika, you know, and that is an ancient Buddhist symbol and Hindu symbol of the sun wheel, as they call it. The swastika runs in Tibet, actually. You know, they make a big deal about which way the sun wheel swastika runs, whether it's running to the right or the left. And in fact, our monastery will always have, which is supposedly the right hand path, the path of white occults, of the sort of spiritually minded occultists, versus the Bon path, B-O-N, as they called it, and that was the left-hand path through dark occult means, black magic, supposedly, and things like that. But the idea, too, the sun wheel, and you know, that's also used in New Mexico, and the Pueblo Indians and stuff also use symbols like that. It's a common symbol, and the Nazis did pick it up in Germany in the 1920s and 30s. But the idea, too, that is showing a vortex pattern, and I think that's what they're talking about, movement of... And I mean, that's part of the whole thing with Vimana's, Einstein's unified field theory, what I like to call Tesla technology, in the sense of understanding, you know, why things work, and a lot of that is magnetism and electricity and gravity are all part of the same thing, which is the unified field, which is what Einstein called it. And the unified field is all these things are manifestations of one force. Einstein called it the unified field. But manifestations of the unified field would be electricity, magnetism, gravity. There's also what they call the weak force or the nuclear force. But all these things come from, say, from the unified field. Now, you have this other thing, and the Germans, who now, what we're talking about, using this kind of ancient... things that the whole swastikas, that what they call the V weapons too, which apparently they named after Vimana's. But all this too was a force that that they called Vril. So here you have what's known as Vril power, V-R-I-L, and Vril was to them, and Vril came from an English, British writer in the mid-1800s, Lord Bulwer Lytton, who was a famous novelist and occultist at the time, and wrote a bunch of novels, and one was called The Coming Race, and in that he talked about this energy, and this energy being all around us. He called it Vril power. Sometimes, you know, people would associate, particularly back then, things like St. Elmo's fire, ball lightning, kind of static electricity, particularly on a large scale, where like whole mountains, aurora borealis kind of things, where they would see these anomalous lights. And even today, you have stuff like the Marfa lights. You have areas of the world, also in the Andes and stuff, where just weird atmospheric phenomena comes, and you have this energy. Wilhelm Reich, the Austrian psychoanalyst who was a friend of Freud's, moved to the United States and died in prison, in fact, his whole movement really was based on a similar thing of orgone energy, which is, again, a lot like Vril. And orgone energy is this ever-present, all-present energy that's everywhere, kind of like the ether. I mean, and it's part two of what many physicists are calling when they deal with subjects like this. And this is going back again to Tesla stuff, and apparently some of the special projects during World War II. Even the Philadelphia experiment, you know, touches on all this, where they're using these unusual energies and what they call zero point energy, tapping energy that's all around us. The idea, you know, that we swim through a sea of energy. We're bombarded by it. Just take a square meter of space, you know, in your living room, and there's energy there. But it's in a stasis of and a kind of equilibrium with everything around it. This is part of two of what atomic weapons and other like super weapons like that would be around, where, you know, by taking something that's normally stable, and this can be mercury or uranium, things like that, plutonium, and then making it unstable, and then perhaps with some kind of explosion. Atomic bombs do need a primary explosion. It has to be a normal explosion first, but then this throws all this nuclear material together, which then pow, detonates and things like that. But it's kind of an interesting thing that, yeah, energy's all around us. Right now we're going through this energy crisis, the idea that power has to be generated through oil, fossil fuel, or coal, or say nuclear power plants, which is basically just heating water. You know, I mean, it could be coal as well, but it's cleaner that way, although it requires all this super enriched uranium and stuff like that. So you have, but the idea is that power's all around us, and you have this real energy, you have this, and today what normal physicists have coined this term, that zero point energy. And in fact, Adventures Unlimited, we publish a number of books by physicists, and it's a popular buzzword, but it's called the zero point energy. And I think this has a lot to do with Vril, also what many of the German scientists were going on about. In Sanskrit, back to the Vimana stuff, you have what they call prana, and it is also prana being this energy that's everywhere. With orgone energy too, you can you move it to your body. It even had, according to Wilhelm Reich, had to do with sexual activity too, and orgasms and things like that. But it's a fascinating idea too, as well, that you can then take energy, these space energy generators, and they're taking power just from the field all around us, the unified field, the magnetic field, They themselves, though, need special parts, apparently. It can be super strong magnets that are perhaps spinning and things like that. Or even if you've got giant crystals, and now you get into the curious topic of these crystal skulls. So you can have these crystal skulls, which are like the famous Mitchell Hedges one. I mean, this is a giant piece of super clear, high quality crystal. And those things themselves, and they're a piece of rock. I mean, they can absorb energy from around it. They can take psychic energy. Even IBM spent years studying that crystal skull and how it worked and all the different things it did. And it, too, it was able to absorb energy around it. At night, Frank Dorland, who was this IBM crystallographer who for years kept that skull in his study in San Francisco, where IBM was paying him to study it. And he would come downstairs and stuff like that into his living room, and here would be this crystal skull glowing and emitting light and energy from it. So, you know, I mean, with that kind of a thing, I mean, that's a thing, but ideally, supposedly, inside these Vimanas, inside probably all kinds of, you would think, spaceships, time travel machines, and things like that, crystals are part of it. And you have even, like, the whole Superman mythos, where he goes to his fortress of solitude up in the Arctic, which is some secret, like, underground, under ice base that is Superman's, and then he puts these giant crystals into these receptacles, and that's how he is, you know, he talks to his father, who's dead, and all that kind of stuff, and all the knowledge from Krypton is kept inside these crystals, and he puts them in a base, and it's something like that. I mean, that is comic book Superman, but yeah, that's what people who, when they get into subjects like that, it's something like this that is going on, and that these halls of records with Atlantis and stuff like that, too, they as well are likely to be these giant, and they're huge, too. And some are in museums where they're perfectly clear quartz crystals that are maybe 2 feet tall or something like that. And in those crystals can be encoded giant databases of encyclopedias and stuff like that. I mean, those crystals, and any crystal can really do this. The ones I'm talking about are really, I mean, they're like giant computers. And the crystal skull would be like this too, with lasers, just like a DVD or a CD. You encode these things with massive amounts of data. And apparently, Vimanas and things like that, I mean, it's one of the central, you know, control things in these things is a giant crystal like this.
See, we have just about 6 minutes till we go to our next break, and we have some questions in the audience. I think we've got enough time to take one. You ready for one?
All right.
Okay, Linda Keeper, you're live and on the air with David Hatcher Childress.
Good afternoon, David, and thank you for being on the show. You seem to indicate by your writings and what you've said on the show tonight that at one time aliens interacted with humans openly. They fought their wars in our skies. They even bombed cities. What do you think happened? Did they leave? And if they didn't leave, why is any possible alien contact with humans in the dark, so to speak?
Well, you know, that's a good question, of course. I'm not actually saying that these wars are fought by aliens. That's not necessary. Other authors do claim that. That's not so much what I think. Although these wars occurred, and they were fought with devastating weapons. I mean, kind of depends on what you think are aliens. I mean, and of course, I mean, all this is that aliens, we'll call them aliens, I mean, we may be those same people. We're not from this planet. We're from some other planet. We're the aliens, perhaps. You have ideas of the secluded planet, too, that you get into. But the idea that people were interacting with, people from other planets, yeah, we'll call them aliens. But the wars on planet Earth aren't necessarily wars that were instigated by aliens, or say, aliens fighting over the Earth. That is one scenario, sure. And other scenarios are more, which would appear to be what's going on. I mean, for instance, there's wars going on right now on planet Earth, and let's start from World War II. That war's never really been over. These wars are still going on. I've always been interested in, Nostradamus and other predictions and these ideas of these antichrists and whatnot. But, is it aliens that are fighting over planet Earth right now and bombing all these cities and destroying them? Most people say no. It's humans are doing that. And ancient wars may be like that, too. Yeah, they were waged with devastating machines, atomic weapons, they destroyed each other. But it's not necessarily aliens doing it. The aliens may be watching from the moon and drinking their green fizzy drinks, from their little space bar inside the moon as they watch all this crazy stuff going on Earth. And, it's a lot like we would maybe, perhaps, is one idea. It depends on what you think of aliens. If aliens are a bunch of... worse than we are. You think we're violent and crazy and whatnot. Well, maybe aliens are even worse than us, right? And they've got to come down here, stir the pot. But in fact, just as we watch other countries, let's look at Pakistan right now. Americans, and including our government, looking at Pakistan, here's a country that's self-destructing. Their own citizens are bombing, killing each other. And there's nothing we can do about it. We can just kind of watch it on TV and sort of hope for the best. Maybe they'll get it together and stop killing each other. That would be cool, and that might be, in a similar way, how aliens watch the Earth. And they're up there on the moon. In fact, it's another story similar to all this. These are all just scenarios. And, I'm opposed to all this, and I can't really say, I'm trying to promote any special agenda here at all, and I'm open to all ideas and things like that. But one idea, too, that our planet's literally in quarantine, and that may be, it's hard to know like this. Again, it's a theory. This is sort of your Star Trek theory of with Star Trek and the Prime Directive and things like that. And planets that just are, say, they're reaching a certain stage of technology, but the overall spirituality of the people is very low. They're killing each other over nothing, over their own kind of crazy, ancient, superstitious beliefs and things like that. And it's violent. And in fact, the economies of these countries, this is what's happening today, is based on weapons and more destructive technology, like atomic weapons and stuff like that. The aerospace industry is so much driven by the military. Today, many Americans make a good living, and in many countries. And what they do is they make bombs, they make mortars, they make things that are going to kill people. And, you could hopefully think of a future world, maybe one where aliens would interact with us, where that's not what our economy is about. Our economy is not, burning fossil fuel in cars and destroying the environment. Our economy is not about building atomic weapons and guns and grenades to kill people. I honestly believe, though, it's sometime in the future when, the world will be a different place. But right now, it's tremendously violent and crazy, and maybe aliens are actually fomenting it and causing it, or maybe they're just watching from a distance and making sure that we stay on our own planet for the time being.
And on that note, we need to head for a break. We'll be right back, everyone, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. This is Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis.
Bumble and the Stingers, Martha Hooper, Rachel Singers, Lonnie Mack, and Twang and Eddie Hitzman, Ringo, going steady, take it easy, take me high, lie, lie, house of fire, poker, motion, poker, passion, deep and verbal satisfaction, baby, baby, got it, give me, gimme, getting hot, as Sandy's cooking, Leslie, Cora, Richie, Valens, and the story, I'm used to Fuji, I'm a Kama Sutra, Rama, Lama, Richard Perry, Spectre, Barry, Righteous, Archer, Nielsen, Harry, shimmy, shimmy, poker, poppin', fancy, baby, king, and poppin'.
Live with J-Rock, but the radio's gold deep.
ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. With your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Thank you.
Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we're talking with David Hatcher Childress. David, we've got a couple other things that we really wanted to get into, but we've got a couple of people in our auditorium that would like to ask a couple of questions here real quick, and we're going to have to kind of, like, go pretty quick, but here we go. Kevin, the mic is yours. You're on, live and on the air with David Hatcher Childress.
Thank you, Dee. Say, David, the astronauts that went up there, okay, they were looking around and they were working and they looked up on this hilltop and there was three UFOs up there. And they called in, now what should we do? And they told them that, or Earth told them to keep on working like they were doing and forget about them. And on the back side of the moon, there's a UFO base or ET base there. And is there the moon hollow? And do you think it was pulled there? And acting like a mothership. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a great question. And clearly, sounds like he's read my book on extraterrestrial archaeology. Yeah, and Maurice Chatelain, who was a German American scientist, astrophysicist, and worked for NASA, and he was a very kind of a Chariots of the Gods, early ancient astronauts from outer space guy, and wrote a great book that's quite interesting, Our Cosmic Ancestors, and he talks about that, and other UFO books, that when the astronauts are on the moon, that, yeah, they saw some craft parked along a crater, and we're told, you know, just do your own thing. There's some interesting footage on YouTube that I've seen over the last year, and I've watched it a couple of times, that purports to be early NASA footage of like Armstrong and those guys on the moon or something, or maybe right after that, and they're going through what appears to be, I mean, it's quite realistic, I hate this, I don't know, but it's like the astronauts going through a derelict spaceship, I mean, like a crashed huge ship on the moon, something like a big cigar-shaped craft or something like that. I mean, and now the whole idea of our moon being hollow and put into orbit around the Earth, and in fact, I mean, I always like drawing analogies to popular movies and TV shows like Star Trek and Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies and whatnot, and the whole idea of this Death Star in the the Star Wars movies. And they build this artificial satellite around this planet, and in the movie, of course, it's going to have this super-duper Tesla-type beam weapon that's going to, you know, can destroy planets, right? So, yeah, I mean, there's something to that in the sense that our moon probably is some artificial kind of a satellite. It's a natural thing. It's not in a natural orbit around our planet. It is inhabited. I mean, people are living on the moon, probably inside it. And in fact, NASA, they talk about all this in the extraterrestrial archaeology book. There are certain craters on the moon they cannot find the bottom to. It looks like there's like ladders or giant structures going inside the moon. NASA, I mean, some of the weirdest things we know about the moon come from NASA. NASA reported that when the command module or the part of the stages crashed on the moon that they ejected after the use of fuel, and it would hit the moon, and the moon rang like a bell for hours, like it was hollow. A hollow metal sphere with these entrances through special craters, and probably too, especially on the dark side of the moon, there are tunnels and things on the moon as well. I mean, just weird stuff. Even NASA later said there was water on the moon too. I mean, and you get into all kinds of stuff. I mean, there are what appear to be weird gullies and stuff on the moon. flat areas that might be flooded with water. That's maybe something that some UFOs do. UFOs have often been seen around large bodies of fresh water, and like say up in all the Canada and stuff like that. And there, I mean, there's a theory too that these giant ships come to the Earth, totally load up with water, much like these firefighting aircraft are doing now in Malibu and stuff, where they swoop down onto the water. Their cargo is, you know, tons and tons and tons of water. But in this case, it's perfectly pure fresh water. And where does it go? These UFOs, they take it, in theory, to the moon. How would you make a moon like what we have, like a hollow thing in the sky? Well, there is a way to do it. And it's the way I explain in my book, also in my video, Extraterrestrial Archaeology. I mean, you could go to the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And the asteroid belt, too, apparently is the remains of some exploded planet. There's what they call Bode's Law coming out from the sun, where you have different planets. And it's a mathematical theorem and logarithmic progression where, as you go out from the sun, there's places where there should be a planet. And in fact, Bode's Law works well for our solar system, where Mercury, like a planet should be where Mercury is, and then where Venus is, and the Earth, Mars. But where the asteroid belt is, according to Bode's Law, there should be a planet there. But instead of being a planet, there's all these rocks in space. It's the asteroid belt. It's like the remains of an exploded planet. Well, that's its own weird thing where, maybe this planet somehow was in a cosmic collision. This would be what Velikovsky might say, or Zachariah Sitchin claims that. But others claim that this planet, you know, there was a planet right there, and it blew up, and that the people on that planet blew themselves up. Then they went to Mars and then came here, and perhaps they're occupying the moon. Here's how you would make the moon, a giant hollow sphere. You go to the asteroid belt. You get a nice big asteroid. You could haul it towards the Earth, or you could just deal with it right there. You have some kind of plasma technology, scalar wave technology, Tesla-type plasma death rays that superheat asteroid, okay? And like a glass blower takes a superheated blob of glass and then blows it into a big glass globe, that's how you would make our moon. You would, I mean, we're talking giant spaceships, huge amounts of energy, a technology that would be in advance of what we have today on our planet, apparently, and would take an asteroid, superheat it into a blob of molten hot rock, and then you would inflate it. And in the end, you could have a hollow sphere. It would have exactly what our moon has, like vitrified maria and black spots. It would have all kinds of rare metals, and in fact, it would be much like our moon is, a vitrified, melted, rocky surface. And apparently, this is how our moon was made, if it's an artificial satellite, at least.
Okay, on the subject of the moon, in dealing with possible extraterrestrial archaeology, Japan and China both have probes going around the moon right now. Do you think that if either one of these probe imaging picks up any structural anomalies that are rumored to be on the backside of the moon, will Japan or China release any of these images undoctored, like some of the photographs that NASA has of the moon, that where they've airbrushed out or pixelated out unusual objects?
Well, right. I think that's a really good question. To me, it's really exciting that the Japanese and the Chinese and other countries have their own space programs and they're going to the moon. I very much look forward to anybody returning to the moon and going there, and especially like the Japanese, Chinese, other more independent countries, where Japan would especially, and both those countries would be good in the sense that within their culture and both countries very scientifically minded. You would think that, that at that point, if they had proof of structures and things like that on the moon, and it wouldn't surprise me if they did. I think that there are photos exactly like that, and NASA is suppressing them. Although in some cases they don't, just because there's just so much stuff up there. And that's what I found with extraterrestrial archaeology when I did the book and the video, was that, I mean, the more and more you look at it, I mean, even NASA is providing you with evidence of all this weird stuff, including these things moving around on the moon. I would like to think that, yes, when the Japanese, the Chinese, and other space programs start releasing photos, video footage, hopefully even their own manned missions, yeah, that it, things will just totally start to change, like what's going on the moon. But, you know, I mean, this is a aspect of the whole UFO enigma and stuff that comes to the moon, the Vimanas, all this stuff, is the aspect of cover-ups, of that certain discoveries have to be kept secret. And I mean, it's one of the things, too, as your many listeners no doubt would have to think about. I mean, once you get into the subject of UFOs, I mean, you've instantly, you know, crossed over into the realm of conspiracy, because, I mean, either the American government and other governments are just totally blind and are, you know, they themselves are somehow just utterly unaware of all this stuff, which seems impossible. But yet, you know, they say that there's nothing going on. I mean, they don't have UFOs. There's not extraterrestrials. You know, this is all just weather phenomenon. They have their skeptical inquirer people who can somehow explain everything as you know, planet Venus or something like that. And so, yeah, I mean, you either kind of think, well, that the government just is unaware of this stuff, or there is a heavy, heavy cover-up going on. Which, you know, I mean, once you actually start believing in UFOs, you have to believe that. I mean, the government just has to know more and more about this. So,
they do.
And, you know, it's like, why would they cover it up? And there are lots of good reasons. We don't have to go into that right now. Even just to protect us. And not, you know, they don't want us to be afraid. The world's economy needs to keep going. You know, there's various ideas there.
Okay, we've got about 6 minutes left. Would you like to tell a little bit about your World Explorers Club?
Yeah, you know, we have our magazine as well, and the new issue is just coming out of World Explorer. Yeah, you can see our mag at wexclub.com, wexclub.com. And our magazine comes out 3 or 4 times a year. It's all about all kinds of unusual, cool mysteries and a lot of lost cities and ancient civilizations and things like that. There's UFO things in it as well. And in fact, the new issue that's just coming out is all about the Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon and how the Phoenix Gazette in 1909 had published this front page story about the Smithsonian Institution finding all of these unusual caverns in the Grand Canyon. Inside were all these mummies and Egyptian and what they thought were Buddhist and Hindu artifacts from ancient India. And that's just one of the articles, yeah, that's in the new issue of World Explorer. Have you seen our magazine?
I just went through the website and was checking some of the stuff, but no, I hadn't heard of it until seeing the website.
You know, I mean, it's an all-color magazine. It you can buy it on newsstands and in some bookstores and things like that. Although it's better to subscribe. We send you a bunch of stuff in the mail, and it's like $25 a year, and immediately we give you I have back issues and stuff like that. But, you know, if it, obviously for people, your listeners, people are interested in the paranormal, kind of new aspects of ancient history, Atlantis, ancient technology, UFOs, cryptozoology too. And in, with Adventures Unlimited and the World Explorers Club, but we, you know, our idea is to promote people to think for themselves and to be informed and, you know, look into these things. We promote world travel. I'm always encouraging people, go to Egypt, go to Peru, you know, go to Stonehenge and stuff like that. See these things for yourself. Check them out. Don't just, you know, listen to the experts. I'm an information, you know, maniac myself. I watch the news constantly, read all kinds of newspapers and magazines and web pages. I want to know what's going on. Yet it's, you know, you've got to filter it out. And more and more, governments, I'm amazed at stuff I see on TV and things where these experts come on and if you're just a normal Joe, you can kind of see, like, well, all right, maybe this guy is an expert, knows what he's talking about. Yet yourself, if you're informed and whatnot, I am constantly amazed at what people say on TV, and they're the experts. And this is has to do with ancient civilizations, with history, UFOs and things like that, what it's like in the past. More and more, I mean, this is what we find, as the age of information is coming on with the internet and radio shows and TV shows too, where people with alternate points of view and fighting special interest groups and powerful propaganda, often coming from the U.S. government, in fact. But, you know, people are more and more able to decide for themselves. And information is much more difficult to suppress now than it used to be. And it's shows like yours that are, you know, helping people make their own decisions.
Well, that's part of what I try to do, is to inform, you know, get the information out there so people can make up their own minds. We've got about a minute and a half yet to go. Would you like to mention your other website for Adventures Unlimited Press?
Well, right, and, you know, we're a worldwide company. We in fact, have bookstores in Arizona, in Illinois. There's one in Roswell. We've even got bookstores in Liverpool and Glastonbury in England, one in Amsterdam, one in Kathmandu. Adventures Unlimited is a worldwide, and the World Explorers Club, company where we network with people, authors, investigators, people who, you know, are open-minded and want to know what's going on. And we publish books. We import books from Australia, South Africa, the UK. We've got DVDs. You can see all this at our main web pages at www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. And that brings you to our main page. You can also go from there to the World Explorers Club and our magazine. But you can see our books. Our books, too, are usually available from Amazon.com and stuff like that. And the books we've been talking about tonight, Extraterrestrial Archaeology, Vermont Aircraft, Technology of the Gods, My Lost Cities books, Anti-Gravity and the World Grid, even like the Time Travel Handbook and stuff like that. If you order from us directly, you know, we send you a bunch of extra magazines. We ship the same day. And we have a big warehouse in Illinois where we do all our shipping from. And you went to our bookstore. Here in northern Arizona, I guess, right?
Yes, I did. I went to the one there in Cottonwood, and unfortunately, we're out of time.
Hey, it's been great being on your show. Enjoyed it.
I've really enjoyed it myself. Thank you so much for being on, and we're definitely going to have to get you back again. You're a wealth of information.
All right. Well, good night, and all the best to everybody and all your listeners.
Hey, thank you, and thanks again for being with us tonight. And that's all the time that we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. stay tuned for Voice of the People tonight, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be Joyce McClellan. And be sure to tune in next week when my guest will be Ted Phillips. So join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.
And there's life that I